Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Need an easy button to feed your baby? Baby Brezza's Formula Pro Advanced makes a perfectly mixed warm formula bottle automatically at the push of a button. No air bubbles, no fuss. Literally, choose your temp, select your ounces, push start, and you're done. Works with virtually all formulas and bottles. Say goodbye to the 3 a.m. feeding chaos and hello to this revolutionary stress-free solution. Raising a baby is hard enough. Let Baby Brezza make feeding a breeze. Get your Formula Pro Advanced at babybrezza.com.
Night falls. Werewolves. Open your eyes and say hello to the pack. You're hungry, aren't you? In silent formation, you prowl between the farmhouses. You smell some warm human blood. The pack gathers in the churchyard to confer. Which of the sleeping villagers smells the most delicious to you tonight? Oh, really? Him. All right. Stagger back to your homes, wash the blood from your muzzles, and go to sleep. Day breaks. Everyone wakes up. There's a sound coming from the town square. The constable's bell is ringing. Something terrible has happened.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And during that introduction, you were either going, OMG, 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 or you were like, what the heck is going on?
That's right. For those of you who don't know what the heck is going on, we were referring to the game of Werewolf, sometimes known as Mafia.
Right. I came to know this game as Mafia. Did you do Mafia first or Werewolf first?
Werewolf first. And that's one of the reasons I'm a werewolf purist on the game. And I look down upon those who play it with a Mafia theme.
Now, we will explain the rules to the game if you don't know what they are in just a minute, but I came to know this game first as Mafia, and I played it when I was in high school. I played it with a bunch of friends of mine down in their basement, and we would play for hours at a time. It could just go on and on and on, and we'd introduce all these ridiculous variations. Because as you'll learn, once you know the basic rules of this game, it can take on any kind of textural overlay you want. It can be about werewolves, it can be about Mafia, or as we did when I was in high school, it can be about elves and orcs. So every time a character dies, I guess they wouldn't die. The moderator would say, "Depart to Valinor."
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah. So basically, it's a social deception or a social deduction party game, depending on how you look at it, in which an informed minority, in this case, werewolves, attempt to overcome an uninformed majority, such as medieval villagers, you know, or vice versa, depending on which team you're playing on. But yeah, it is a deceptively easy game to learn. I found that just about anybody can get into it, even if you're not a gaming person. Because you'll frequently, I'll frequently find myself at a gathering, and not everybody will be a board game geek. There'll be some board game geeks there, but it's hard to bring everybody together on what to play. This is one of those games that brings people together.
Well, right. If you're at a party and you say, hey, let's break out the D20s, it's time to play Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are not just going to be weirded out by the geekiness of it, but they're also going to be like, all these rules, I got to learn how to play. It's really... For some people, they just don't want to be bothered with all of the minutiae of how to play the game and what the hit points are and everything. Right. Werewolf is like a version of D&D that takes away almost every single rule and strips it down to just pure role-playing. And basically, the only dynamics in the game are accusation and lying and killing.
Yeah. And you don't need a board. You don't need to buy a copy of the game, though there are some nice print versions of the game available. But basically all you need are just some index cards or scraps of paper and a willingness to either draw a werewolf and some villagers on them or just throw some W's and V's and hand out the scraps.
Robert, you have made me this morning an amazing collection of werewolf game player cards on, I believe, How Stuff Works branded envelopes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because you can really use anything and you can just throw them together at the drop of a hat. So it works well if you're with people at a cabin or something, or even in a hotel room. You can grab that Howard Johnson notepad and the Howard Johnson pen and
rip out pages of the Gideon Bible.
Yeah, if you want to go sacrilegious on it, you might have to tweak the fluff there a little bit for it. But
right.
This game is just a wonderful balance of, to put it in those gaming terms, simplistic mechanics, but deep mechanics once you start playing with it, and then entertaining fluff.
Yeah, and they will eventually prove scientifically and technologically relevant, which is the interesting thing and what justifies this foray into the land of the werewolves today. But I think for those people out there who have never played the game and are still going, what's going on? We should describe the rules, right?
Yes.
And hey, I just wanted to let you know, we played a few rounds of Werewolf with our coworkers here in the office at How Stuff Works, and so we may play a few clips for you from those games, and I wanted to give a shout-out to our coworkers Alex, Lauren, Tari, Ramsey, and Sarah for being really great sports and for killing us again and again.
Yeah, they really got into it. We had to remove a fair amount of cursing, but it was worth it.
So at the beginning of the game, you gather together a bunch of players. And every player is randomly assigned a card telling them their role. So for most players, you're going to be a villager. For a select minority, in a group of, say, 8, mm-hmm. your select minority might be like 2. And those players are going to be werewolves. Then the game proceeds into 2 phases that repeat back and forth, night and day, day and night.
Now, a game master runs the game and informs everyone when to close their eyes, when to open their eyes. So you would say something like, all right, villagers, night falls in your sleepy medieval town. Everyone closes their eyes except for the werewolves. Werewolves, open your eyes and indicate who shall die tonight.
Right. So the werewolves silently confer, they mm-hmm. usually with some kind of eye contact or pointing game, and they figure out who they want to devour or, I don't know, just disembowel and leave in the middle of the town.
Yeah, I mean, that's the delightful thing about being the game master is you get to throw in details about how they're torn apart.
Right.
All right, the sun comes up. But not for you, horse trainer.
Darn it.
He was eaten right down to the boots tonight.
Didn't even get a chance. It's a little less pressure now that I'm dead.
Can I loot the body? I need some supplies.
Robert, what's your favorite tear apart story?
Oh, generally I just have like a portion of the individuals left behind because I like the idea that the werewolves are becoming so confident that they don't even have to eat everything. And they're just as happy to spread terror throughout the town as anything else.
I'm still so full from that policeman last night.
All right. So night eventually comes to an end. That phase ends. All the villagers wake up. They find out who has been eaten or torn apart in the night, and then they have to dish out their own medieval mob justice.
Right. So the dead villager who's been chosen by the werewolves is removed from the game. Mm-hmm. And I would say for total purity, I think that villager should not only be removed from play and can't make any comments, but should be banished from the room where everyone is playing, or at least sent to the corner. There've got to be some stakes.
Well, but then you have somebody who gets eliminated right away. And mm-hmm. what I usually say is, look, you're a ghost now and you can't talk. You can observe, but you can't talk. And it's always amusing when the biggest chatterbox in the room is reduced to a ghost.
You're the grandpa in the cloud in the family circus.
Right.
but yeah, so like you said, day comes around and the villagers have to essentially form a mob mm-hmm. to find the killer and take care of them. Now, since these are werewolves, they're very powerful at night. You can't stop them at night when the full moon is out. But during the daytime, they're just regular humans, and you can take them to the gallows if you are pretty convinced that they're guilty. But how convinced are you?
That's right. So it comes down to a lot of blind accusations, a lot of, you know, self-interested accusations. Mm-hmm. And the cool part, too, is that you have werewolves in there trying to uphold their cover as a human, and they're going to make a case, too, probably for a non-werewolf because they know who the other werewolf or werewolves are.
Yeah, why would they accuse one of their own? So
right.
If you're Alice the werewolf, you don't want to accuse Jeff the werewolf. You want to accuse Rodney the villager of being a werewolf.
Right, or jump on someone else's suspicion.
Yeah.
And then start encouraging that, anything to cast the suspicion away from you. And at the end of all of this, there'll be some sort of a vote.
Right.
The villagers will decide who's going to be executed for the crime of lycanthropy. And then, only then, and I think rules may vary on this, but the way we play it is that at this point, they can perform an autopsy and they find out if that was indeed a werewolf.
Oh, okay. So in some versions of the game, you don't find out. You mm-hmm. don't know whether you just executed an innocent villager or a werewolf until the end of the game when it's finally revealed who was who.
Ah, that sounds rewarding as well. Because on one hand, with the autopsy, it gives the person a chance to see, like, I told you so. I told you I wasn't a werewolf.
Right.
But on the other hand, I do like
you're
the
idea. You're a ghost
idea.
And you can't comment.
Right. Well, I like to think that's their last thing they get to shout before they drift into the nether realm.
Nice. Okay, so you've got this day-night cycle where some player dies and gets removed from the game every day and every night, and the cycle continues until the end of the game. So what brings about the end of the game? Well, you can tell which team wins if suddenly the werewolves outnumber the humans.
Right, or in some versions, I think if they equal the number of humans.
Well, right. I mean, if you got the same number of werewolves and villagers,
yeah.
And the villagers don't stand much of a chance.
Yeah, then it's just werewolves slaughtering humans in broad daylight.
Welcome to Werewolf City.
Yes.
Now, of course, the regular villagers win once they eliminate all of the werewolves in their midst, and the moderator can announce to them, you've gotten the last one, your village is safe for now, until the next game starts, which is probably in about 5 minutes. Now, that's the basic game of werewolf or mafia. Mafia is exactly the same, except instead of werewolves, they're mafia members.
Yeah.
Same rules. Everything is just different texture.
Yeah, different fluff, which I have to reiterate that I think werewolves are tremendously more fun mm-hmm. because I don't like playing my cool parlor game with murderous criminals.
Right.
I like the idea of the fantastic werewolf.
We've got to be monsters, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are a million different ways you can throw some spice into this game, right? Mm-hmm. People play this game with all different kinds of crazy invented third-party characters. So it's not necessarily just villagers and werewolves. What if you add in – Robert, give me another player class.
Oh, the one I love the most is the Seer.
Okay, how does that work?
The Seer has a separate phase in the night.
Okay.
So there's the phase where the werewolves get to open their eyes – and pick out who's going to die and then close their eyes. But then you have another phase where the seer opens their eyes and they get to point to one person and the game master will give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down about the presence of lycanthropy. So this gives one villager the chance to have secret knowledge. Generally, it's, you know, the odds are going to play out that it's probably going to be about who is not a werewolf as opposed to who is a werewolf. But then they have to be careful about tipping their hand in the arguments that follow.
Exactly. So you say day comes around and you say, well, I know Jeff is a werewolf because I'm the seer and mm-hmm. I got the thumbs up on him last night. Guess who's going to die tonight? Yeah. Obviously, the person who's revealed themselves as the seer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, there are other variations on the privileged knowledge character. There is, for instance, the innocent child. And this is one I tend to not use. Mm-hmm. But this one involves one player who gets to peek during the night.
So it's risky. So instead of having a separate phase in the night where you can ask the moderator, you have the option, if you choose, to open your eyes while the werewolves are conferring.
Right. And this gives, of course, the werewolves a chance to actually spot you spying. Mm-hmm. So it adds this extra level to the play, I guess.
Now, one way I know I have played is with a character that would be a doctor, or maybe even better would be the apothecary.
Oh, yeah? How does this one work?
Well, this is kind of like the seer, but instead of asking the moderator, every night the doctor can choose one person to make immune.
Ooh.
So say the apothecary they wake up at a different phase in the night and they give a potion to someone. And if that is the same person that the werewolves have selected, that person gets saved by the potion. The werewolf attack does not succeed.
Oh, that's nice. There's one that we sometimes use called the hunter, where they get to take somebody down with them if they die.
Oh.
Which adds some sort of like shootout mentality to the proceedings.
Wow.
Another one
if that happens early in the game, the hunter probably is going to be randomly getting another villager, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems with a real, itchy crossbow finger, you know?
So tell me about the Cupid, Robert.
Oh, the Cupid is one of my favorites. So this is just a villager, basically, but they get a phase at the very beginning of the game where they get to secretly pick two players to be star-crossed lovers.
Mm-hmm.
So if one dies, and they could be a human villager, or they could be a werewolf, you know, masquerading as a villager. But if the other lover dies, their character throws themselves off a bridge.
Love knows no boundaries.
Yeah.
Monsterdom.
Yeah. And so this one also adds that sort of crossfire dynamics of, whoa, this happened and then something else happened as well.
Now, you can imagine that the strategy in this game is odd because at one level, it seems like when you start the game, you're just going to be making these totally random accusations. I mean, what do you have to go on? Maybe you thought you heard somebody next to you opening their eyes. I mean, it's hard to have anything to go on at the beginning of the game other than just mere suspicion. But strategy, I do think, tends to come in more as the game goes on.
Yeah, that first phase of play, I think there, in my experience, there are basically two elements that are going to work. Unless somebody really does creak their chair and make a very audible sign that clues in everyone else, mm-hmm. you're going to have existing social dynamics coming into play. So like two friends who kind of pick at each other a lot.
Okay.
They're likely to accuse each other of being a werewolf just because. Other factors, if an individual in the group has a large beard, I have found they're likely to draw the fun suspicion of everyone else because there's nothing else to go on.
What if they've just got dark, dried blood on their lips?
That'll do it too. Now, another thing that comes into play, so is this. When I play it, when I am the game master for a game of werewolf, I generally ask everyone to choose a role in the village. This is not a game mechanics role, but just a fluff role. So you're just a villager, but you get to...
I'm the dairy farmer.
Yeah, you get to be the dairy farmer, or you're the, you know, you're the town fool, you're the, you work at the winery, you're a monk, etc. It just gives it an extra level of role-playing fun.
What do you all do here? What are you up to in the Democratic Republic of Catatonia?
I'm a tailor, but I'm real bad at it.
Terrible tailor.
Making terrible clothes.
Yeah.
I'm the leecher. I do the leechings in the town.
I hear that helps prevent lycanthropy.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, useful.
A lot of industry sprung up around this whole werewolf thing. For instance, I build coffins.
Oh, okay.
Coffins, leechers, terrible tailors.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I'm the town wannabe werewolf.
So like, werewolf groupie.
Yeah, I'm the werewolf groupie, so I don't really have a job. I just like go from North Catatonia to South Catatonia, and I'm just like, ooh, look at the werewolf remains.
So you would not be want to kill a werewolf or put one on trial, eh? Or is that your thing?
Yes.
No. I'll leave it there.
The werewolf trauma has really had an effect on the population.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, all right.
I'm a warlock.
Warlock.
Ooh.
Okay.
Cast spells.
Do you need any fancy robes?
Yeah.
I can make them uncomfortable.
I need you to come by my place at 3 to do another werewolf protection spell.
Sure.
My place
sure.
from werewolves.
Sure.
Right. At 3.
I'm a midwife.
Ooh.
All right.
Oh, man.
I feel like you may be the only person doing anything noble here.
No, nobody in this village makes food. Nope.
So we've got a warlock, we've got a midwife, we've got a groupie, we've got a terrible tailor, we've got a coffin maker, and we've got a bleacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's just a voice that tells you things that happen. Like right now, as the sun sets in the hazy sky, and the babbling brook comes up. If there are two werewolves among us, let me see your eyes.
But this can also give people ammunition for making blind accusations in the opening phase.
Okay, so sometimes the accusations wouldn't be truly strategic just in terms of winning the game, but they might be playing along with some, you know, not actually strategic elements that are just part of the fluff.
Right.
So it's this weird mix of rationality and irrationality in the gameplay.
Yeah, I would say so. But in terms of player classes, classes that have mechanics attached to them, the list just goes on and on. There are tons of fun classes to play with. Some of them, you know, they kind of break the game. Mm-hmm. And you decide, well, we're not going to have that one again. Other ones introduce new mechanics, new dynamics that can just keep you playing werewolf into the wee hours.
Here's the one I would go with. Tell me if you think this would break the game.
Okay.
The RoboCop. So the village has one RoboCop
uh-huh.
that each night can administer harsh justice.
Just to a random individual? Or how does the RoboCop decide? I guess the RoboCop's following some, you know, a list of orders.
Well, it's by the rubric of serve the public trust, protect the innocent, and uphold the law.
Huh.
And then maybe a secret fourth category.
Oh, yeah, of course.
We don't know.
Well,
but, hey, Robert.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing. We've just described this weird game about killing your friends and then accusing your friends and then killing more of your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this so popular? I've had the experience that whenever you introduce this to a group of people, especially if they haven't played before, they get ravenous for the game.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they're like, yeah, we got to play more. Let's keep going.
Yeah, it's so very addictive. And I think the appeal of the game does come down to a few key reasons. So some of these we've already touched on, but first of all, there's a very low learning curve. Virtually anyone can play.
Yeah, it doesn't have D&D rules. It's just you can learn it in 5 minutes.
Right. And also, again, while you can buy some pretty cool print versions of the game, everything you need is easily printed out or just scribbled on index cards and you're good to go. Again, Howard Johnson, a stationery and pen, and you're playing Werewolf. And then there's this. If anyone out there has ever played Rock Band or Guitar Hero, at a social gathering, you know how that can just sort of create...
That was popular for a while.
It was. And I always noticed how it just turned the room into just this zombified state.
Yeah.
Where people aren't really interacting socially with each other. They're only interacting with each other in this soulless presentation on the screen.
It's like what was imagined by the bad guys in the movie Videodrome.
Exactly. Yeah. Werewolf, on the other hand, it actually encourages social interaction among the players, as well as varying degrees of role playing, depending on, you know, how comfortable the group is with that. But that will come out organically as you play.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like a lot of great games, it's deceptively complex, easy to learn, but full of new twists and challenges as the players adapt and as new optional rules are introduced. So you learn to lie better and you get better at spotting the lies of others. And as you're doing a lot of back and forth role playing as well, it just gives you more and more ammunition.
Now, I know there was one interesting article about this game that was published in 2010 in Wired that we both read. And one of the things that it points out is that this game is tremendously popular among people who work in the tech business. That's a kind of odd thing to note. Like, why do you think that is?
Yeah, this was an interesting article. They talked to Frank Lance, director of the New York University Game Center. And he pointed out that the game sanctions a lot of titillating social activity.
Hmm.
So we're talking stuff like flirtation, confrontation, betrayal, meaning that it's not only great for extroverts, because obviously a bunch of, you know, extroverted theater majors are going to jump in and have a lot of fun with this,
uh-huh.
but introverts as well. It's instantly have license to engage in all of this fun social interaction.
Yeah, stuff that you might normally be very intimidated to do in real life is sanctioned within the game. So there's a lot of direct eye contact and accusing people and being, yeah, like you say, just being very confrontational. it's appealing to do that in a controlled setting for people who don't feel much permission to do that in the rest of their lives.
Right. So Frank, he pointed out that this obviously ended up appealing to more introverted members of the tech industry. Mm-hmm. However, there's a CNET article from 2009 that pointed out that the game was also a hit with more of the corporate types as well.
Mm.
Because sure, you're not pitching an idea to a room full of investors, but you are a secret werewolf trying to shift blame onto an innocent human. And that's basic CEO material, right?
Yeah, that's like what they teach in business school.
Yeah. Or you're a seer or a child with secret insider info when you're trying to make a purely logical case without revealing your privileged status. So the level of social interaction can be seen as practice for actual villainy or just this fun exercise that lets you, move social muscles that don't get a lot of exercise otherwise.
I can't wait to get all the CEO hate mail. And this is going to be great. And like Mark Zuckerberg's writing in, you guys are totally biased.
P.S. Not a werewolf. Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a theory about why the game is so appealing. And I think it's that it mirrors and simultaneously simplifies so many high-stakes, real-life decision dilemmas because the dynamic, sort of like you just mentioned with the idea of this business, you know, you've got some biz bro who is a secret werewolf and trying to pull one over on the people who are being disadvantaged by what he's doing. The dynamic of the informed minority versus the uninformed majority is so common in the real world. Basically, this is a description of what is meant by the word conspiracy.
Ah, yeah, it's a werewolf conspiracy.
Now, the concept of a conspiracy, I think, gets a bad rap because it gets associated with the more wild versions, like conspiracy theories tends to mean people who think interdimensional Sasquatches did 9/11. But there's no doubt that under the broad definition, conspiracies exist all around us. Like any criminal gang is a conspiracy. Every network of corrupt politicians and people who buy favors from them, that's a conspiracy. It's an informed minority trying to get advantage over an uninformed majority. Unethical companies, of course, as we mentioned, could be described as conspiracies. And in every case, there's this small group working against the interests of the larger group, trying to keep their behavior secret and avoid accountability. Meanwhile, the larger group is trying to root out all the people who are working in secret against them. And it's entirely possible in all these real-world scenarios that this will lead to innocent people getting blamed and unfairly punished. And so Werewolf is cool because it reduces these most vexing problems in human civilization to this simple party game, this really distilled dynamic. And one of the cool and appealing things about Werewolf is that at the end of the game, you always get to find out what actually happened, right?
Yes.
Even if you lose, there's resolution to the mystery. You know, in our constant prosecution of the various mundane conspiracies in real life, time after time we find that we can't be certain what really happened. You know, the bad guy gets away with it and you never find out what they did or who they were. Or you prosecute somebody and they claim innocence all the way to the gallows and you can never really be sure you did the right thing. The appeal of Werewolf, I think, is you get to play this dangerous game that we're all constantly playing in real life in simulation, and you get to find out for sure how well you did at it.
All right, listeners, on that note, I'm going to ask everyone to close their eyes as the commercial break session of play commences. And then when we come back, you may open your eyes, and we will discuss the history of Mafia and Werewolf. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today.
A-S-T-E-P-R-O, allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
The warlock goes by the coffin shop at 3 p.m. He's a very punctual warlock. He's coming to do that spelly thing. He's got his books. He's got his uncomfortable robe on that the terrible tailor has tailored for him terribly. The coffin maker's nowhere to be seen. So while he's waiting, the warlock is taking a tour of the facilities. Opens a little baby coffin, nothing but spider webs. Opens a medium-sized coffin, empty satin liner. Opens the large-sized coffin. And the coffin maker is within.
Oh.
Everything except for his face.
The apothecary. I don't have many direct dealings with her.
Now, the apothecary has wanted to be a werewolf for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should just kill her.
All right, open your eyes. The sun has risen.
Now, we've established that the clearly superior version of this game is the one with the werewolf fluff instead of the mafia fluff. But right. We've got to admit, it was mafia before it was werewolf.
It was definitely mafia before it was werewolf.
Invented by a guy named Dmitry Davidoff in, I've seen 1986 and 1987 cited. I guess it was just around that period of 86, 87 in Russia, right?
Yeah. He was a teacher in Russia. And I think this adds to the appeal of the mafia
motif. I don't know. Yeah, and he invented it as a psychological exercise for his students.
Yeah, so he was a psychology student at the time, and he was teaching high school, and he explains that he wanted to teach psychology concepts, but thought that this type of game might be better at teaching some of these psychology concepts, or at least more appealing to students than, I don't know, say a traditional lecture might be. I can certainly imagine why classes would have more fun playing Mafia than they would listening to you talk about the latest findings on the science of deception.
Exactly. Now, Wired interviewed Davidoff in 2010, and it's a fun article to look up.
Yeah,
I recommend
the same
it.
One we mentioned earlier.
Yeah. I'll try to include a link to it on the landing page for this episode. He insisted on being interviewed by Wired within the MMO World of Warcraft, for starters.
Dude, that's even better than saying I'll only do an interview in Second Life.
Yeah. And he was extremely dodgy with some of his answers. So the resulting interview piece spends most of its time placing him within the context of his Russian upbringing before moving to the United States. So he was born in Kamensk-Uralsky near the Kazakhstan border. And this was not too far from the 1957 Kyshtym nuclear disaster. The Chernobyl explosion, which we've discussed on the show before, occurred in 1986 while he was designing Mafia. He was teaching high school at the time, as we discussed, and he taught the game to his students. And the crazy thing is, it kind of just spreads out from there.
Yeah, and one thing I love about this article is it establishes that he's about as weird as you would suspect from somebody who invented this weird social deception virus that infects people's parties all around the world now.
Yeah.
I know I already mentioned Videodrome once today, but it makes me think, you know, a person who says I will only be interviewed within World of Warcraft is like Brian Oblivion in Videodrome, who will only be interviewed on television on a television.
Oh, man. There's so much potential to create a horror franchise about some sort of a social deception game like this that just spreads. And it spreads so easily based on just how addictive it is and the various benefits of play, as we've discussed already.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing, too, here is that this is largely a pre-internet age in which it's spreading. So it really doesn't start picking up online until after 1997. That's when it hits the U.S., according to accounts that we were reading. And this is where Andrew Plotkin, a.k.a. Zarf.
Zarf.
Yeah,
okay.
You might know him as Zarf. He's the one who picked it up in the U.S. and updated it with the werewolf fluff and then began distributing it, spreading the word of it online. So he told Wired magazine the following in 2010. I was fascinated with the game design. I had never seen a game with such a pure strategic underpinning. No mechanics to be strategic about. It was what poker would be if you didn't play with a deck of cards, but bet solely on other people's bets. It shouldn't have worked, but it did.
I think he's exactly right about that. Like, it's kind of hard to understand what's so appealing about the game until you play it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder out there, if you're somebody who's never played this game before and you're listening and you don't get it, you're like, what is fun about this? It just sounds boring. You've got to try it. I suspect your mind will be changed.
Yeah.
Or maybe this is an occasion for more hate mail.
And I should point out, too, that the game is so simple that not only is it a popular physical parlor game, like where people physically gather in a space and play with each other, it also is played a lot online in online communities because you don't have to have as long as you have a basic social interaction platform, like just a basic chat room, you can play werewolf.
Yeah.
You really don't need much, much more. As long as you have some method of randomizing the roles.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty simple programming feat.
I guess
that's all you need.
Yeah. As long as you've got some kind of side messaging, private messaging service. Yeah. You can do it.
Now, another thing I love about Werewolf is how closely it resembles a couple of key movies. One of which I know that you love as well.
I know where you're going, but hit the first one first.
Okay, so there's a 1974 film titled The Beast Must Die.
Good title.
It stars Peter Cushing, a 34-year-old Michael Gambon, Charles Gray.
Oh, 007.
Yes, he played Blofeld.
He was Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever.
That's
right,
yeah. He played the criminologist in Rocky Horror, and he also played Mycroft Holmes on the Jeremy Brett Granada Sherlock series.
I'm sure he was great at that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, he was great, and he was terrific in everything.
He is dry as a bone,
yes.
That man.
This is a very dry British film, as one might expect. And it's a werewolf whodunit based in large part on the Agatha Christie book and movies, And Then There Were None.
Uh-huh.
So the film climaxes with a scene in which everyone gathers in a parlor, and they're tested with, I think, a silver candlestick. They pass it around to see who's a werewolf.
Mm.
And this is the only movie that I know of to feature a werewolf break. This is a brief intermission for the audience to discuss their theories on who the werewolf is and then vote on the werewolf before you get the big reveal in the movie.
Now, the really great version of this would be that the audience vote determines which reel they load into the projector and becomes the werewolf in the final scene.
Yeah, that was not the case, though. It was just a chance to discuss what you thought about the movie up to that point. But I feel like we need more werewolf breaks in our films, even in non-werewolf films.
Right.
Say, for instance, you're watching Glengarry Glen Ross.
The movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are no actual werewolves in it, but I think that it's constructive to have a point where the audience talks about who might be a werewolf.
Well, there's a burglary scene. Like you could say, pause to discuss film, and everyone pauses and goes into a extremely profanity-laced discussion about who broke into the office and stole those leads.
Right. Now, another great scene that comes to mind that is very reminiscent of werewolf is, of course, the scene in John Carpenter's 1982 film, The Thing.
Oh, I love it. It's the best. The scenes where you're doing the test to determine who's got thing blood and who's got human blood.
That's right.
If you've never seen The Thing, it's one of the best horror movies ever made. And it's got what's so great about it, apart from just the music and the cast and all that, is that it's got these scenes where they're trying to figure out who's the thing.
That's right. And in the original John Carpenter adaptation of it, not the original film version of it, obviously.
The Howard Hawks.
Yeah. In Carpenter's version, they test everyone's blood sample one by one, sticking a heated piece of copper wire in there to see if the blood acts to defend itself, because the blood would act independent of the individual because it's a crazy shape-shifting organism.
Right. Each part is its own organism in The Thing.
Right. And so that's the test in that version. However, in the 2011 remake, it's kind of a remake, it's kind of a prequel, I thought it was still fun.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people kind of ragged on it. But they do an alternate version of the test by checking to see who lacks amalgam dental fillings, because the theory is that the thing can't form inorganic matter or can't replicate inorganic matter.
What? So if you practice good dental hygiene, they're just going to burn you alive?
Yeah, it's not as satisfying, but it's still amusing. That's kind of my general review of the film.
Okay, so if you're still with us and you haven't just paused the podcast to go play werewolf with your friends, you're probably wondering, what is that stuff we referenced earlier about werewolf showing up in academic literature? Well, werewolf is an interesting game from several standpoints, and one of those standpoints in academic research would be game theory, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, in general, you see it popping up in a lot of different academic papers, a lot of different psychological studies, even AI studies, as we'll discuss. And a lot of it just comes down to the fact that this is a simple game that depends heavily on deception and also social interaction and observational skills.
Good things to model in computers if you are very sinister.
Yeah. And as Davidoff himself points out, it's not a game you can master. So, yeah, you can do a certain amount of math in your head, sort of card counting, I guess, but it's only going to get you so far. And it's ultimately difficult to predict who is going to win, werewolves or humans, which this is another wonderful thing about it. And another reason why gaming can go on till 1 or 2 in the morning, because you don't reach that point where everyone's figured it out and you've essentially beat the game, or you've evolved beyond this game and you need more complex games. The crazy thing, of course, about all of this is that the game started out as a sort of psychological exercise, and it comes around full circle and becoming a tool in various psychological experiments.
Yeah, or a tool used to generate data sets for psychological experiments.
And remember how we said that you don't need a board, you don't need dice, you don't need any other materials. You just need that card that you glance at once and then stick in your pocket or, you know, push up under your butt while you play. That's another key advantage here. The cards are just initial reference points, so there's really no reason to break from communication and immersion with other players. This is especially important for studies that factor in gaze pattern. So it's, in a way, it's like poker without the cards. It's just a pure social experiment.
Right, yeah. You don't have to look at your cards. You don't have to go examine your character sheet. You're just in the world.
Yeah. Like there's a game that has some similar style to it called Spyfall that came out a few years back, and it's one of these that if you're up for the work, you can create a pen and paper version of it, but you generally have to buy a set. But it's a game where there's a lot of fun social interaction, but you end up referencing sheets a lot to remind yourself, like, what are the possible locations to guess in the course of play. It's still a fun game, but there is a distraction element to it that is not present in Werewolf.
Okay, so we're going to game theory, psychology, and artificial intelligence. Let's look at game theory first. How does this game figure into game theory?
Well, I guess we just need to define what game theory is real quick for anyone who's not familiar with it. Its origins lie with John von Neumann and Oscar Morgenstern, and they introduced game theory to the world in 1943 with Theory of Games and Economic Behavior.
So basically, this is the study of systems that have differential payoffs and different actors within them that have competing motivations, right?
That's right. As David K. Levine of the Department of Economics at UCLA points out, it's an economist's take on what a psychologist would call the study of social situations. And you have two branches of game theory. Broad branches, you have cooperative and you have non-cooperative. I think these are pretty straightforward. And then you have sub-branches that include decision theory, general equilibrium theory, and mechanism design theory.
Now, if you've seen papers on game theory before or explanations of game theory before, one thing you're going to see a lot of is, for example, tables of payoffs, where you can have axes along a table that show different kinds of decisions you can make within this system, whatever the system is. It applies to various, you know, vast different kinds of situations, but different decisions you can make within the system and what the probability of different payoffs for those decisions is.
Yeah, the creation of, say, a matrix that shows you what the different payoffs are based on different player decisions.
Yeah.
Like the classic example of this is, of course, the Prisoner's Dilemma.
Yeah. So this is a game where it's a very simple version of a game where you don't know what the other player is doing, but you can make smarter decisions and less smart decisions depending on what the potential payoffs and punishments are for different decisions you could make.
Yeah. And when we say game, it's not a fun parlor game way Werewolf is, but it's just the mechanics of it are simple and fairly interesting.
Yeah.
The idea is that you have two prisoners. They each were brought in because they're suspected of robbing a bank.
Okay.
And they have money stashed away somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the police are trying to get each one in a separate room to turn on the other.
Yeah.
So
rat out your buddy and you'll go free.
If neither rats, then they both go walk free and get their 50% share of the stolen money.
50%? What if I want more percent?
Well, then you got to be willing not only to rat out your partner, but be darn sure that they are not going to rat you out.
Because they're faced with the same problem.
Exactly. So if you both rat each other out, then you both go to prison and that money just rots in a hole somewhere. But if you rat them out and they don't rat out you, then you get to keep all of it and they rot in a hole somewhere, or at least in the penitentiary.
So yeah, depending on what the different types of payoffs are, there are ways of solving this game. And I guess in the case where you're comparing money versus jail time, you would have to sort of render the jail time in a monetary value or something.
Right.
But you can work out probabilities of what your best decision should be given decision matrices like this.
Right. Now, as you can imagine, this relates to werewolf because you have it's a great opportunity to try and chart out the motivations and respective payoffs for both villagers and werewolves.
Yeah. Now, part of the problem with werewolf, though, is it depends very much on what variables you allow to come into play. Because as we've said, the game is deceptively simple at its core, but there's all this stuff going on in it that makes it more complicated than the simple rules would lead you to believe.
Yes. And then you have, of course, all these social elements that are coming into play as well, especially in that opening round. Like how do you create proper probabilities for, hey, Ramsey has a really long beard and looks kind of like a werewolf, so we're going to just blindly accuse him of murdering a villager.
Well, I mean, we would say that in reality, since we know the cards are distributed at random, that would be basically a random accusation.
Right. But I've seen just that first round random accusation pick up a lot of steam. Because ultimately, there are no real-world stakes to werewolf.
Of course, the question is, do players actually do any better when they're playing with some kind of strategy than they would if they were playing randomly? We'll come back to that.
All right, so we're not going to hit you with a bunch of matrices and equations here. And we also can't possibly cover every study, every proposal, every research project to use Mafia or Werewolf. But we're going to touch on some of the interesting studies, and it's worth recognizing some of the recurring features of these studies.
Yeah.
So more often than not, you're going to encounter a very boiled-down version of the werewolf rules.
So no Cupids or anything.
Right. Like, generally, they're going to be most interested with just villagers and werewolves, no detectives, no seers, or what have you. Because, let's face it, those are pretty great mechanics just right out of the box.
Right.
And also, we mentioned the social dynamics that come into play, and these, again, can be very difficult to model.
Yeah. So you might be wondering, as a matter of course, generally who wins when you play this game? You've got werewolves versus villagers. Is there a standard way to predict who wins more often? Well, there was a probability paper called A Mathematical Model of the Mafia Game in 2013 by Piotr Migdawa. And it found – this is a big caveat, but it found in a simulation where all killings are random, so nobody has any special information, in each round the villagers execute somebody random and the werewolves kill somebody random. In this version of play, quote, it turns out that a relatively small number of the Mafia members – i.e. proportional to the square root of the total number of players gives an equal winning chance for both groups. So if your number of Mafia members is about the square root of the total number of players, it should be roughly 50-50. But the game isn't always that simple, and maybe players are better than random chance. What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, especially when you factor in all these just additional aspects of the social dynamics. So the author here, he has another quote that I think sums up the difficulties of modeling the game.
Yeah.
He says, quote, "A dry mathematical model may be a backbone of a more complex one, but certainly is not enough to describe a real game. During course of play, citizens gain some information, either by discovering another's identity by themselves or trying to catch messages. Furthermore, voting may be subject to some kind of witch hunt mentality. Moreover, rarely are all players the same. Usually there are ones with higher and lower influence on the others."
Right. So some people are just really good at leading the angry mobs to drag somebody to the gallows.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people do actually get some kind of useful information in the course of play. I discovered a section in a book that goes into some of these interesting variations on the game. And so Robert, see if you'll follow me down this path.
All right,
want to see how this compares to your werewolf experience. So the American writer Adam Gopnik, you might know him from good essays in The New Yorker.
His stuff's come up on here before.
Yeah. He published a book in 2008 called Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York, which is basically a memoir about life in New York City, especially after 9/11. And in one section of the book, he talks about this period where his friends have become addicted to a variant of werewolf, though the version they play is Mafia. You know, you can't judge them too harshly. They are in New York. So that's a touchstone for them. And they play in groups of 15 to 20. With three Mafia, a narrator called God, one Commandante, who's the detective character, basically the same as the seer, and then the rest are villagers.
Oh, man. That's a big game. I like it.
So Gopnik's played a lot, and he reports that the villagers win more often than the mafia.
Hmm.
So a minute ago, we saw that mathematically, if players are doing no better than random, you should predict about a 50-50 chance for each team to win. But Gopnik says the villagers win more often. And he says that in his experience, the best starting strategy if you're a villager is simply to look at everybody's face as soon as God commands you to open your eyes. And basically what you do is you just look around and you try to get a feeling for who looks guilty. Believe it or not, he says in his experience, this works better than you would expect.
Hmm.
Which, if he's correct about that, that would indicate that we do have some kind of natural guiltiness detection system built in how we recognize other people's faces. We might get to more about that in a study we look at in a minute. But as the game goes on, he says deductive reasoning becomes more important. So you look for, say, patterns in who gets killed after accusing whom. So you might start to notice that everyone who accuses Alice of being part of the werewolf mafia tends to get killed the very next night. You can probably guess what's going on. Then again, they might just be trying to throw you off the track. People are crafty. Gopnik writes that the ostensible pleasure of the game is in testing how good you are at lying, and how good you are at spotting lying behavior in others. Like, it's this captivating question. You always wonder how good you are at spotting a liar because it's hard to know in real life. Like I was talking about earlier, real life is full of so much ambiguity and questions that are never resolved in trying to root out the deception of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one excellent section. I just wanted to read a quote from his book and see if it matches with your experience. So Gopnik writes, quote, "The really fascinating thing about mafia is seeing how much pure irrationality lingers in its play, how little real deduction and how much sheer panic govern its conduct. The game quickly breaks down, as social groups will, into small circles of belief, which become lynch mobs of mistrust on the next turn. As these small circles within the group form and break, the emotional authenticity of the alliances, the felt pleasure of trusting another, is startlingly, frighteningly real. I think it's Larry. It must be Larry, George says to you, filling his eyes with sincere persuasiveness, leaning forward, confident, conspiring. And you nod with conspiratorial glee. Yes, it must be Larry. Look at him. And for that moment, the bond between you and George is so intense as to overshadow your general and complete lack of interest in George as a person. You and George against the mafia. But then the quick nightly shadow intrudes. What if George is the mafia? Yet the proper suspicions, though they rise, rarely override these instant bonds. The impulse to trust and go on trusting a confidant is so strong that it often survives even overwhelming evidence that the confidant is a rat." So, Robert, you've played a lot. Does this match your experience? Do you think that the game really, more than anything else, hinges on establishing bonds and connections with other players?
I think it is a huge part of it, and it gets back to that sort of icebreaker quality of the game, because I've certainly played it in settings where I don't know a lot of people,
yeah,
and there'll be like a large portion of the group that is, you know, another friend group,
right,
that I'm not privy to. It's interesting to play in a group like that because he mentioned connection, the connection that exists during these accusations in the middle of all of this debate.
Yeah.
And it does give you this amazing chance to have this really intense connection with somebody that you're maybe even not even sure what their name is right now. You just
right.
know them as, oh, well, they're the bread baker in the medieval town.
Right.
And that's maybe as much as you know about their life, but you have this intense connection based on the game.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, that's another reason as the game master, I like to dish out the different – or not dish them out, but ask people to choose a role in the medieval village.
Right.
Because it gives you something to refer to if you don't know their name yet.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You can just say, oh, if you can't remember it's Carol, you can just say, and then the cobbler of the town is found dead. And you don't have to say Carol.
Well, I've got an observation along similar lines. Gopnik says another part of what's great about the game is it eliminates the need for other conversation and small talk with your neighbors at a party. He says, quote, "Instead of telling them elaborate social lies in an unformed context, you get to tell them elaborate social lies in a formal one."
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this comes back to just the immersion of the werewolf gaming experience, because it is often the case where people just go, they just go all in on it.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be talking about anything else. They're not talking about the, you know, the day that everyone had or what supper was like. They are just all in 100%.
Yeah.
Firing along these new communicative pathways.
Yeah. One more dynamic he mentions is that the game is actually filled with mini games based on existing relationships. Specifically,
yes.
He singles out couples that are playing. Each couple tries to catch the other, the partner in that couple lying, and focuses primarily on whether they should be suspicious of their own partner. Does that match your experience
as
well?
Yeah. I mean, especially in that opening round of play, they don't have anything else to go on except existing real world social connections a lot of times, and those end up being used. And then when people start making accusations, those social dynamics come into play as well. It's another reason I really like the Cupid role, because you get into this, why does the Cupid choose these two people to be star-crossed lovers?
Right.
You know, is it because they're actually a couple? Is it because they were, like, teasing each other early in the evening?
Uh-huh.
Or it's just hilarious to think of them as lovers?
Yeah, to make them embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah. So that is a case where it adds this extra level of interaction, not only with the in-game social dynamics, but real-world social dynamics as well.
Right. It's like dad humor. Like, tell us about your boyfriend.
Exactly.
Okay, we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the science of deception and werewolf.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Kapow!
Oh, autopsy report.
Well, we pulled back her werewolf costume, and beneath was but a human.
Oh,
you should never pretend to be a werewolf.
Wait a minute!
What is this?
Werewolves triumph again?
Unfortunately.
Ow!
I was the seer. I knew that she was a werewolf.
You never got to play.
Oh my god.
And I never got to be the werewolf.
Well, such is life.
And the first thing I was going to do is declare that I was the seer and point out the werewolf.
That is so noble.
You got it right.
Yeah.
Man.
That would have put a whole different dynamic that we had not yet experienced.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You.
Good thing we offed your head in the beginning.
Being very aggressive.
Tari, who do you think is
the werewolf?
And I don't
like it, and I think you're the werewolf.
I don't know. I kind of think Joe is, because he's been...
I'm not.
He's been
I'm seriously not this time.
I would say no.
Sides. I'm trying to get a vibe on somebody, and she actually seems kind of sincere.
I think Robert.
I think maybe Robert.
I, again...
Look at that devilish grin. Look at that sly, devilish grin on his face.
This is the grin of someone who knows perfectly well that their soul is pure.
Look
that
at
my hard work has scrubbed away
hard
whatever
work.
Minor
sins.
Glowing with satanic delight. Look at this.
Now, earlier we mentioned a Wired article from 2010 about the game, and it addressed this question of the scientific study of deception and what psychology can tell us about deception within the game of Werewolf. According to a gaming psychologist at the London Metropolitan University named Simon Moore, there's actually not much diversity in our skill at spotting liars. According to Moore, there are not human lie detectors walking among us. Quote, if you ask someone on the street, are they better at detecting a liar than a police officer, they'll probably say no. But a police officer and a general person both have a 50% success rate at detecting liars. Man, that's frustrating. You would hope there would be people who would be better at it among us.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly, when you do start using lies, you become even more self-conscious. You think, oh, they're going to see right through it. But really, they have a 50-50 shot.
Yeah, exactly. So that's at first, though. Certain circumstances, according to Moore, do tip the balance and change our ability to get away with lies and also to detect lies in others. For example, when you're stressed, it's harder to get away with lying. Now, we all know about the fallibility of the polygraph test as a true lie detector test.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some truth to the principle on which the polygraph test is based. It's just not necessarily as reliable as it is often depicted in fiction or maybe even in some people who actually use it. But the principle it's based on is that lying causes these physiological stress reactions in the body, that it, you know, messes with your heart rate, it messes with your blood pressure and stuff like that. And as you get more stressed, it gets harder and harder to lie. So this would sort of mean that at the beginning of the game, lying might be easy when there's not much pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
As other players get eliminated and the spotlight narrows on you and the stakes of the game go up, Moore predicts that it's going to be harder and harder for people to get away with lying without people seeing through their facade.
Yeah, because early in the game, especially if you have a larger group, it's easy to just sort of sit there quietly and just side with this faction or another.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as things proceed, you have to be outspoken. Otherwise, people are going to be suspicious of your silence.
Right. And that actually is a factor in another study I'm going to mention in a minute. Now, Moore also says lots of our lies are lies of exaggeration. I think we probably know this from experience. People are more likely to sort of turn a half-truth into a big exaggerated claim than they are to just blatantly say something that is completely untrue with no basis in reality, right?
Right.
People are more likely to fudge than just to make up a total lie. And so blatant lies like, I am not a werewolf, when you know you are more difficult than these kinds of exaggerations. But Moore also says it's easier to lie about straightforward information than to lie about your own emotional state. So if you're trying to put on a show of outrage, like, you know, how could you accuse me of being a werewolf after all of our friendship or whatever? Mm-hmm. How could you accuse me? You quickly exhaust yourself, and Moore says that a person doing that is going to start to falter at this deceptive performance. The feigned outrage turns into sort of more simple objection, or turns into other emotions that are easier to fake, like aggression, and people will pick up on this. You start to look like a dirty rat.
Yeah.
And this is given as an explanation for why the villagers actually win more often than a simple random choice would predict. Villagers at some point do start to be able to notice people lying.
And we have some studies to back this up.
Yeah, some studies that are generally conference proceedings here. So who knows exactly how correct these claims are, but these are some claimed findings on how to detect deception that we found related to the game Werewolf. So one was called Are You a Werewolf? Detecting Deceptive Roles and Outcomes in a Conversational Role-Playing Game. And this was presented at Acoustic Speech and Signal Processing in the 2010 IEEE International Conference. And the authors here created this automated method for detecting players determined to be liars by analyzing the acoustic properties of their speech patterns. So I thought that was interesting. Can a computer just listen to quantitative elements of what happens when somebody speaks, mm-hmm. and say, I caught a liar here? So they tried to correlate that. They tried to find, okay, can we listen with the computer and see, does it detect patterns in lying? And they claimed that it did. They said their method could successfully predict lying behavior better than chance just by listening to acoustic properties. What does this mean for human players? Well, one simple finding seemed to be that liars speak less.
Huh.
Presumably to limit their risk of making revealing mistakes.
This is interesting because one thing I've definitely seen before is you have a case where someone's a very outspoken werewolf critic.
Yeah.
You know, they're very outspoken. They're going to be the lead detective in finding the murderers in the village.
Uh-huh.
But then there'll come a game where they're suddenly a lot more quiet.
Uh-huh.
They're not making all these accusations. They're not right at the front of the crowd with the pitchfork.
Right.
And people notice and they say, well, John is kind of quiet this round.
Right.
Suspiciously quiet, as if perhaps he is a werewolf.
Yeah, come on, Cynthia. Didn't you have some zeal for werewolf killing in the last game?
Yeah, yeah. Suddenly you've gone soft on lycanthropy?
Yeah, so that does seem to be a good tell. People who are trying to maintain deception offer less information. They just talk less, and it's pretty easy to see why. This study seems to confirm that finding. Also, it found that, quote, the distribution of pitch and energy values are higher for liars. So according to the study, if somebody is raising their voice in pitch and volume, they're slightly more likely to be a liar.
Oh, okay. That's interesting because I know that I have I sometimes raise my voice, mm-hmm. when I'm lying about not being a werewolf.
Really?
Yeah. I'll be like, well, how dare you accuse me of that sort of thing. Now I'm going to have to be careful. I'm going to have to keep it low.
You got to talk more and you got to stay calm.
Yeah. But how do you stay calm about something like this?
Look,
villagers are dying.
How could you accuse me of being a werewolf? Here's the thing. I'm not a werewolf, and the reason is.
Yeah, and this is actually where the fluff becomes nice, the
right.
sort of villager fluff, where you can say, well, how could I possibly be the werewolf? I am the cobbler.
Uh-huh.
I have to make shoes all night. If I was running around slaughtering townspeople,
uh-huh.
then everyone would be barefoot.
Right. Okay, so a couple more. One was a 2008 paper by Zhao and Sung, which was called Cues to Deception in Online Chinese Groups. And this is a sample group of Chinese players playing online. The authors found that, quote, deceivers tended to communicate less, yet again, so people who talked less were more likely to be liars, but also, quote, showed low complexity, and this is in their speech, meaning, for example, shorter sentences and shorter words. And then they continue, and high diversity. So that means, for example, more unique words. So their analysis found that you want to look for a liar, look for the one who doesn't talk much. When they do talk, they might talk in shorter sentences or less complex words, but use more unique word choice.
Interesting, interesting.
Okay, one more. This was a 2015 paper called Detection of Deception in the Mafia Party Game. Obviously, we got some people who don't understand the benefits of werewolf. And this one presented another automatic system for lie detection. This time it was based on facial cues, so the movements of eyebrows, eyes, and mouth on videos. And this one's kind of hard to explain because it's hard to translate what they found about facial movement analysis into words here on this podcast in a useful way. But just quickly, some of their tentative findings apparently show that eye, eyebrow, and mouth movements caused by lying might be those more associated with fear, guilt, or delight, while truthful facial expressions might be those that you would more closely associate with sadness. Okay, but this is all with humans, right? Humans and arguably some werewolves.
Right.
I don't know how the game would change if you had real werewolves playing among your party friends.
Ooh, but that would be great. If werewolves were real, we'd have to get them in one of these studies and see how they play.
But what we've not looked at so far is computerized players.
That's right. And there are a number of cool studies that look to this. Because another great way to use werewolf is if you're studying either lie-detecting robots or robots that lie. And when I say robots, I'm, of course, using the fun version of robots. We're actually talking about programs and or very soft AI to try and determine patterns of human behavior.
Well, no, actually, so to clarify, I guess we have looked at a couple of papers that claim to have a method for determining some kind of automated lie detection. Mm-hmm. We haven't looked at AI liars yet.
Right.
And we haven't, I guess, looked at like robust AI players that incorporate information about lie detection or that really try to get in the mind of the liar, just more like they're detecting correlations and things sorted out by the humans. Anyway, let's look at some AI lying, okay?
All right. Well, I was looking at a presentation titled The Great Deceivers, Virtual Agents and Believable Lies.
Good.
And this was by Diaz et al. They'll come up again. And this was presented at the 2013 proceedings of the annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society.
Okay.
So they used werewolf, and they used werewolf, not mafia, so thumbs up.
Yeah.
They used it to test a two-level theory of mind model for virtual agents. Now, theory of mind, of course, just to refresh, that is our basic human ability to conceive the mind state of another person.
Right. It's absolutely crucial for lying, right?
Right.
It's kind of hard to lie if you can't imagine what somebody else's mental state is, because in lying, you're trying to make their mental state not correspond to what you know to be true.
Right.
Now, why would they be doing this?
Well, they wanted to see which version, either a one-level or two-level theory of mind model, would make this actor seem more socially intelligent.
A one-level or two-level theory of mind model. Okay, so let me guess what that is. One-level theory of mind is, I know what you're thinking, or at least I'm imagining what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Two-level would be what? I imagine what you're thinking about what I'm thinking?
Yeah, you get into that whole, would he tell me that this door leads to the center of the labyrinth sort of a situation.
Right. So you're modeling someone else's theory of mind in two-level theory of mind.
Right. So here's a quote from the paper, just to boil it all down. Two versions of the werewolf agent were implemented. One has a single-level theory of mind, able to represent what victims believe, but not what victims think it or the other victims believe. The second has a two-level theory of mind, able to represent what victims think about what it knows, and in general, what victims think about the suspicions of others.
Woof.
And then both versions had inference rules to determine suspects.
Okay. Now, I would generally imagine that a computer that tries to go two steps down the rabbit hole would be better at lying and detecting lies, right?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what they found. They found that a two-level theory of mind werewolf had a leg up on single-level theory of mind villagers. And then a follow-up test showed that that indeed the two-level theory of mind werewolves were also perceived as being more intelligent than a single-level theory of mind werewolf. And of course, this becomes important when you're just you're not talking about like how to build an AI that is going around deceiving people or certainly going around killing people in the night, but just how to create something that comes off as more human.
Right. I mean, it does sort of make you think that some of the same skills that are crucial for deception and constructing elaborate social lies for the people around us are the same skills that are good social lubricants and make us get along well with others. That would be a depressing finding, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's somewhat true.
Yeah, this sort of thing is ultimately about creating chatbots for the future that feel more human when they're scamming you. Now, another presentation we ran across from 2014, and this was another IEEE International Conference presentation, and this was by Dasuki Katagami et al., titled Investigation of the Effects of Nonverbal Information on Werewolf.
Okay.
And
so wait, is this an AI werewolf or an AI werewolf detector or both?
It's, the purpose of the research, they stated, was to develop an intelligent agent, quote, AI werewolf, which is enabled to naturally play werewolf with humans. So it's all about machine learning.
Right.
Their findings were, quote, we found that nonverbal information in the game of werewolf has importance to winning or losing the game.
Okay.
Which, you know, is kind of an overstatement of the obvious, I guess. But here we see it proven out in this cool AI werewolf study.
Now, people sitting at home might be thinking, why are we specifically training computers to be good at killing us in the night and getting away with it?
Well, again, it's more that these are extreme versions of the skills that we use every day.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to that CEO analogy we made earlier. The average person is not engaging in such titillating versions of social interaction, but we're engaging in varying lesser versions of them.
Yeah. Yeah, in the same way that you see animals wrestling at play when they're children, you know, to sort of distill some of the main dynamics of physical struggle for survival. I guess this is sort of an adult version of wrestling with words and eye contact.
Yeah.
You know, it's that most primal of games, but done at the abstract level, at the level of social interaction rather than just rolling around on the ground.
I'm glad you brought up the children, Joe, because there was – I'm going to mention real quick here that there was an additional study I came across, Werewolves, Cheats, and Cultural Sensitivity by Lim et al. And this was a 2014 conference paper presented at Autonomous Agents in Multi-Agent Systems. And this one was really cool because it basically boiled down to having children observe two different virtual games of werewolf.
So they're not playing, they're just watching.
Right. There, I think they use the term imaginary friend. Like you're not a player, but these are real people supposedly playing and you're observing their game. And the version A and version B have slightly different rules. So one version seems far more unfair. And so basically they were using the game as a way to just look at cultural sensitivity or insensitivity and attempting to model it. It's interesting, though. They said that it didn't work out all that well. The exercise actually caused the children to reinforce their view that the in-group is correct and that the out-group is incorrect rather than seeing that there are different ways to go about it, different ways to play the game.
I feel like that is a common dynamic I've come across multiple times is that studies find some attempts to discourage toxic social cognition can often seem to reinforce it. Mm-hmm. Does that seem like something you've come across before?
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, it brings us back to werewolf because what is werewolf but a game that looks at toxic social interactions?
Yeah. It's the only game where you get to have a vigilante mob that kills somebody every single day.
That's right. All right, so there you have it. Now, obviously, we would love to hear from everyone out there, certainly newcomers to the game of werewolf. If you listen to this episode and then you go out and try it for yourself, we would love for you to report back. However, if you've been playing this game for years and years now, we obviously want to hear about your favorite additional rules, maybe some even homebrew rules that you've come up with. Let us know about it. Give us your werewolf tales or your mafia tales, and we'll chat with you about them.
Here's what I want to hear. If you already have a werewolf group that plays regularly, if you can find out a way to incorporate a RoboCop character class in a way that doesn't break the game and heightens the tension and makes it even more fun, write in, tell us about it, and we guarantee we will read that on the air.
All right. Hey, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is where you will find the landing page for this episode. You'll find all the past episodes, and you'll find links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. And hey, over on Facebook, that's where we have a group, the Facebook group, Stuff to Blow Your Mind Discussion Module. Hop in there. That's a great place to have longer form discussions with other listeners and with the hosts.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, the old-fashioned way, the version that might be used by some medieval villagers conferring about how to kill a werewolf in their midst, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand-washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.